Keokuk, Lee County, Iowa. Donald Trump struggled mightily in the 2016 election to win over the two-college degree, two-car garage, two-income families that fill up America's subdivisions, a group that has been the core of the modern Republican coalition. But you wouldn't know that from talking to people like Joe Steele in Keokuk, Iowa, a Mississippi River town whose faded Gilded Age glory is still visible in its residential neighborhoods and on the wide streets of its downtown district. Steele is the chief executive officer of the Lee County Economic Development Group, and it's his job to help solve the unemployment problem in the locality, which has the second highest jobless rate in Iowa. The county today has 34,615 people, fewer than were recorded in its post-Civil War census of 1870, taken soon after the city's most famous one-time resident, Mark Twain, called Lee County his home. A holder of bachelor's and graduate degrees in banking, a civic leader, and a political centrist, Steele fits the profile of the exact kind of right-of-center voter most likely to have defected from Trump. But he didn't. Unlike his demographic peers in the suburbs of Houston, Dallas, Denver, and countless other metro areas, Steele and the people like him who populate the civic service clubs in the small and mid-sized communities of the Great Lakes region, the Rotary Reliables, voted with their neighbors and not their economic or educational class. Much has been written about Trump's large gains among working-class whites, but barely noticed has been the resilience of his support among the upper-class whites who live among the red-blooded and blue-collared. If you're in larger cities and things like this, you flock with people much more like yourself, Steele says. Where in rural America, there's a huge cross-section, and you're a part of that cross-section. Sitting in the conference room of a spec building in an industrial park now home to the Economic Development Agency, Steele projects the thoughtful calm you'd want from your accountant, relaxed in a dark checked button-down shirt, large glasses sliding slightly down the bridge of his nose. "I think that we're more diverse," is a good way of putting it, Steele says of the social circles in places like Keokuk, where blue and white collars worship together, fish and hunt together, and in 2016, vote together. Steele is literally a Rotary Reliable, a member of the local Rotary Club, a business leaders group founded in Chicago in 1905. But he just as easily could be a member of the Lions Club, Sertoma Club, Optimist Club, National Exchange Club, or Kiwanis. All groups that have international footprints today, but strong histories in the Midwest. Members meet weekly or biweekly, usually for a Dutch treat lunch, to hear program speeches about other professions and to plan local charitable service projects. Even as the institutions of formal connectedness decline in America as a whole with the rise of the casual links of social media, these groups still form a backbone of the leadership class in many small and mid-sized communities, particularly in the Midwest. The emblems of these groups still adorn the city limits welcome signs in towns across the region. And if you want to find out who the movers and shakers are in a heartland community, you can probably find all of them at noon on Tuesday or Thursday in the banquet room of the town's oldest restaurant. In addition to his Rotary membership, Steele has volunteered for the local chapters of the American Heart Association and United Way, been president of the YMCA, and helped develop Bentley's Playground, a specialized playground for physically challenged children. Aware of Trump's obstacles among white-collar voters in larger areas, Steele believes the economic crisis in much of the Midwest enabled Trump to succeed with the same kind of voters in places like Keokuk. Rotarians, or just call them leaders within rural communities, they know what makes their community tick, and they saw that high unemployment, Steele says. He is reluctant to talk politics at all, and he deftly pivots questions about Lee County's role in the election through the prism of the county's economy. Looking at it from a Lee County point of view, high unemployment was not good for our area, so therefore, there needed to be a change. As much as you can help guide that change, you want to be a part of it. And that's part of the reason Trump carried this southeasternmost county in Iowa when no other Republican had in recent times. Trump won Lee County by 16 points, the same margin by which Romney had lost it 4 years before. 8 consecutive Republican nominees for president, including 2 Bushes and a Reagan, had lost the local vote here before Trump took it in a runaway. Even beloved former Republican Governor Terry Branstad only carried the county once in his 6 successful gubernatorial campaigns. Lee County was the buckle on the Democratic belt in eastern Iowa that kept the state one of the most elusive prizes in the Midwest for the GOP. Lee County wanted to see change, Steele says. We were the poster child for unemployment. There were orders leaving the country for, let's just say, product that wasn't as good as the product that could be manufactured here. Things went overseas, and they were into high volume, low dollar, whereas here it was lower volume, higher quality. Even though it has higher unemployment than most other Iowa counties, Lee County still holds on to a diverse manufacturing base, albeit over a smaller footprint than at many points in its past. Steele, the economic recruiter, reels off the list of survivors like a man who makes this pitch often. All the staples of the historic Iowa economy are represented. Agribusiness giant ADM has a local plant, as does canned meat mega producer Pinnacle Foods. Anyone who's ever opened a can of Vienna sausages out of his or her school lunchbox has tasted Lee County. It's a mainstay, Steele says of the plant, formerly known by the Armor Foods moniker. They've been continually reinvesting in the plant. The Mississippi River hits a natural fall line near Keokuk, and railroad giant BNSF has long had one of its major transcontinental river crossings here, along with the footprint that comes with the smaller railroads running the switching operation involved. French food additive maker Roquette owns a large industrial presence making corn-based sweeteners in a riverfront facility that has traded hands over decades. Agrochemical company Scotts Miracle-Gro has its second largest American factory here, and DuPont has a paint plant, a legacy of the Upper Mississippi River Valley's once dominant position in the international chemical sector. Outside the traditional Iowa industrial base is a plant on U.S. Highway 218, midway between Keokuk and its co-county seat, Fort Madison, that at first glance looks like the exterior of an airplane hangar, with massive wing-like structures, longer than any vehicle, lined up on the asphalt outside. They're wind turbine blades, made from fiberglass by Fortune Global 500 company Siemens, in what used to be a tractor-trailer factory. And the shining anchor of the county's most recent economic development efforts is a gleaming new $3 billion fertilizer plant that has just risen out of cornfields in rural Weaver. With a projected annual payroll of $25 million, lured by more than $108 million in state tax credits, the Dutch-based, Egyptian-controlled, corporate parent of the Iowa Fertilizer Company offers hope that southeastern Iowa is doing more than just nursing its historical industrial base through hospice. The list of corporate nationalities of the surviving job providers in this county reads like the roster of a UN subcommittee, demonstrating that even the counties in Trump country are now intertwined with the global economy, even as their voters push back on the excesses of globalism, a complexity that often went uncovered by journalists who chose only to paint Trump voters as nationalists in the ugliest sense of the term. In the years after 2008, when the Schaefer Penn Corporation closed up in Fort Madison after a century of making riding implements here, many feared that the county's future was irreparably bleak. According to Steele, the reality is that places like Lee County have to focus on workforce development as much as recruitment in order to regrow their job base in the age of automation. Our plants are in desperate need of good, solid, skilled workforce. That's the number one thing they're all telling us, he says. He is aiming for an education system that doesn't channel every student into a four-year college, where they might fail or get skills unsuited to the economic opportunities of the technical industrial jobs of today. Some people are better off to graduate from high school and go learn the trade, he says. They can learn that, they can go to work in a plant, and perform a function and make very good money. Others can go on and get that associate's two-year degree. And then there's going to be a smaller percentage that will go on to four-year colleges but finish. Steele has four grown children, and the youngest still lives in Keokuk and works in the supply chain of a local factory, using his associate's degree. In his spare time, when he's not doing community work or playing with grandkids, Steele likes to hunt, and his hunting buddies are mostly plant managers or factory accountants, people with white-collar jobs in blue-collar environments. Like Steele, the son of a truck driver, they all feel equally comfortable at the Rotary Club lunch or talking taxidermy with guys on the factory floors. Unlike the bankers and economic developers in suburban cul-de-sacs of larger cities, Steele and his crowd were not subject to the social pressure to oppose Trump. Quite the opposite, they were surrounded by people voting for Trump, even breaking party allegiances to do so. But that commitment to Trump may not last. At least in Steele's view, places like Lee County could flip back to their Democratic political roots just as quickly as they shifted to Trump. I think this area here always does a wait and see, and they're going to want to see progress, and they're going to judge that progress when the next election cycle comes around. Michael Martin, Erie County, Pennsylvania. In the summer of 1972, the remnants of Hurricane Agnes spread destruction across the mid-Atlantic for 3 days. The onslaught of heavy rain was so severe it washed out foundations from homes, destroyed entire business districts, and tore up highways and bridges in its wake. The ruin spread from the Hudson Valley in New York all the way here to Lake Erie. It took lives, livelihoods, changed the shopping habits of locals for a generation, and hastened the looming economic recession of the 1970s. The storm also did its best to derail Michael Martin's ambition to go to college. The middle child of seven children, Martin had just graduated from high school and was about to enter Edinburgh University in Pennsylvania to become a teacher. That is what I would call an interesting time in my life. An organization had come to me. They had asked me if I would go into a program for them, and they would pay for my college education. 2 weeks before school is supposed to start, Hurricane Agnes came through. The sponsoring organization didn't make any money in their summer bazaar, and they said, "Hey, we don't have any money to send you to school." And life just tripped me along to where I'm at today, Martin explains. The son of a school teacher and a nurse, and one of seven, he had no way to pay for his education. So Martin got a job driving a delivery truck for a company that sold paper and packaging materials to industries and businesses in this region. After being in that position for about a year, the general manager of that operation offered me an inside sales position, and then a year later, he offered me a sales position, and I never looked back, he says. Today, Martin sits in the conference room of his own paper and printing company, thanks in large part to a storm that changed the fortunes of an aspiring schoolteacher to those of an entrepreneur who employs 30 people and finds a way to give back to his community in every spare second he has. The community involvement comes naturally to Martin as the grandson of the late Joseph C. Martin, a former Democratic mayor of Erie, its first port commissioner, and a sports editor of the Erie Daily Times. I grew up here in Erie, Pennsylvania. I'm a fifth-generation person here in this community from my family. We must have been horse thieves. They wouldn't let us leave, he jokes. For most of the country, the enduring image of Erie is that of a third-tier Rust Belt city down on its knees, filled with ghosts of its industrial past, haunting the remains of the hollowed-out factories and manufacturing facilities. But if you grew up in western Pennsylvania, eastern Ohio, or along the western panhandle of West Virginia, the Erie you know features different imagery. It's likely where your family spent a summer vacation, thanks to the miles of beaches along Presque Isle Bay, on a peninsula jutting into Lake Erie, and protecting the city's harbor on the backside. The large park has long been used by landlocked working-class families who could pretend it's a reasonable facsimile of the ocean within a 2-hour drive from home. The Waldemeer Water World, an amusement park lovingly maintained by a local family, sits at the gates of the state park and offers a throwback to the prototypical beach scene of half a century ago. For the local people of Erie County, this spot is a combination of a lakefront place to raise a family, a place steeped in religiosity, and a place to wager you can carve out a successful life if you are willing to reinvent yourself as the manufacturing world changes underneath your feet. It is also a place filled in the summertime with tourists in clapboard cottages, campgrounds, and old-fashioned mom-and-pop motels that dot the city's shoreline along with a kaleidoscope of sleek sailboats, small yachts, and modest fishing boats. Across the bay, the remnants of industry anchor the city proper. A General Electric train engine plant that is the last giant remaining from Erie's industrial peak. It recently lost its standing as the largest employer in town. Fewer than 3,000 people now work at the Union facility. In its heyday, it employed 15,000 people. In the lead-up to the 2016 election, 1,500 workers lost their jobs. In 2017, an additional 200 were furloughed. Since then, GE's transportation division has moved its headquarters to Chicago and opened up a new plant in largely non-union Texas. GE just announced a sale of 100 locomotives to Egypt, but that may not yet be good for our town, because, again, a lot of those jobs have disappeared around the world. And they've built a new plant in Texas, Martin says. For each one job that is lost, an additional 5 others are as well. Waitresses, small businesses, mechanics. Every single job lost costs another one in the community. Like many Rust Belt counties, Erie has seen a great departure of manufacturing jobs in many sectors in the past decades, headed offshore or point south. When jobs move, people move next, and Erie County's population of 276,207 is lower today than it was in 1980, even as the state's population has grown by 8% and the nation's by 43% over those 2.5 decades. The quickest replacement for lost manufacturing jobs has been a focus on tourism, both the existing base of regional lake tourists and those drawn to newer attractions, such as the 22 area wineries. We're trying to resurrect it as a tourist town, but tourism jobs don't pay what manufacturing jobs pay, Martin cautions. After years of decay, the private sector and volunteer leaders of city and county are partway through the pains of reinvention. Martin, who has been a committee member of the Chamber of Commerce, vice chair of the Transit Authority, chair of his township zoning hearing board, and on both the Board of Governors of the Philharmonic and the Board of Governors of University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, UPMC, knows a little something about reinventing to survive. It all began for me with Agnes. I had to change course. Did I think I was going to drive a truck forever? Of course not, but I was willing to find out where it would lead me, he says. He came from a family of Catholic Democrats who were thrilled when John F. Kennedy won the presidency in 1960. I don't think Kennedy would get elected in today's world on either side. He wouldn't be far enough left for the D's, and he wouldn't be far enough right for the R's, Martin theorizes. Since local politics ran in the family, Martin recalls some political discussions around the family table. Global issues were kicked around concerning where the country was at, and what should we be doing, what we shouldn't be doing. My family believed in the Vietnam War. My family believed in that we needed correct civil rights. I believe then, and I believe today, the vast majority of Americans are moderate. Martin voted for Donald Trump, and in him, he saw a politician who did not fit the frozen ideological grid. We're not far left. We're not far right. I think that's one of the things that was borne out in this last election. Martin is charismatic, confident, and direct. Qualities that likely guided him along the way from the cab of a paper company delivery truck to eventually owning a printing company. His conference room is wide and welcoming and filled with natural light thanks to a broad skylight overhead. A large picture window that looks out onto a freshly cut lawn in front of his business, and a glass wall that separates the room from the reception area. Dressed in a green and white checkered short-sleeved shirt and khakis, he wears glasses that frame a face topped with closely cropped sandy blonde hair. He has the build of a former linebacker, or maybe a Marine. Martin's printing company is surviving, thanks in part to a solid market share. In my industry, virtually all of our competition is gone too. It doesn't have as much to do with technology as it has to do with what was here. We used to have four banks headquartered here. There's no bank that's headquartered in Erie now because of all the acquisition of things that came along. This used to be known as the paper capital of the world, with Hammermill Paper Company here. That company's gone, he says. As the customers for printing decline locally, so does the competition for Martin, who took over his own company when it faced desperate choices. During the turndown in the economy in the early 90s, I was a straight commission salesman, Martin says. Many of my customers were either being acquired or they were going broke. The company I presently own was one of my customers who we had to shut off because he couldn't pay his bills. And about a year later, he and I chatted because my customer base was falling apart. And we constructed a deal that I should come to work as a minority owner with the opportunity to buy the rest of the stock out over a period of time. I pretty much bought a company that was technically bankrupt. He credits one thing for its recovery. Building a solid reputation. For quality, for on-time delivery, and for affordability. Before I bought it, the company had a great reputation for quality, great reputation for on-time delivery. Price affordability was something it did not. So I started negotiating with customers. All around Martin in his conference room is evidence of his success and his philosophy at the sheet-fed commercial printing company. Cheery direct mail pieces, college admission packets, and business portfolios for the medical industry, hospital programs, and private schools. And non-profit mailers of different sizes and approaches are pinned to a board on one wall. Several framed testimonials are on a long shelf on another. Other Erie companies were not so lucky. The town has had a lot of changes, Martin says. We've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs. We used to make steam shovels here. A company called Bucyrus Erie, gone. We used to make kids' toys here. Lewis Marks Toy Company, gone. We used to make boilers and things. Skinner Engine Company, gone. Zern Industries, which makes that little apparatus that automatically flushes toilets, was headquartered here, and it's virtually gone from our landscape now. Martin has seen the consequences of Erie's economic struggles beyond the numbers as well. They aren't just felt structurally. They don't just impact tax bases. they mean neighborhoods deteriorate, as homes and small businesses shutter when no one is moving in to replace the exodus, or to buy their groceries or widgets in the local stores. Churches close too, including the one the Martin family had been a member of for generations. He partly blames the population loss, but also the emergence of a less religious society. Is that tough? Yes. But I do understand. Nothing's the same forever. Things change. Because our country has changed, and I unfortunately believe we've become less faith-based. Faith requires accountability and responsibility, and nobody wants to be accountable for the actions, and nobody wants to be responsible, he says. Martin agrees with the professional staff of Erie's Regional Chamber and Growth Partnership. The long-term path forward for this city likely centers not around manufacturing or tourism, but around the EDS and MEDS imprint, the anchor assets of universities and hospitals. The universities and colleges in the region literally connect their communities to our community and connect all of them to the world. That kind of innovation can serve as a building block to a stable foundation economically, says Rick Novotny, executive director of the Erie County Redevelopment Authority. What we strive for in success is a balance in our economic landscape. Yes, manufacturing will still be a part of that, but so will growth in education, medical and medical technology, hospitality, and professional service sectors like the insurance industry, Novotny said in a recent meeting with several members of the Erie Regional Chamber and Growth Partnership and Redevelopment Authority. The director is also a bit of a maverick himself. I voted for both Ross Perot and Donald J. Trump, he says proudly. The other members of the authority staff at the meeting did not share his enthusiasm for Trump, but they are all in agreement about Erie's path forward. They must be making progress investing the community's leaders in the strategy, because Martin, plugged in as a community volunteer, can recite it when interviewed separately. Erie does have the potential to attract professionals like professors, doctors, scientists to the region, Martin says. EDS and MEDS is a base that allows you to do other things. We're fortunate we have Gannon University, Mercyhurst University, Penn State Barron, Edinburgh in our backyard. The real interesting little school we have here is Leacom Medical School. Leacom is the largest osteopathic medical school in the country. Started here about 25 years ago. What EDS and MEDS doesn't do well is employ, with a family-sustaining wage, the unskilled person who did not do well in school and isn't able to get a job sweeping a floor in a factory. Many of those workers are still here. If you take a look at the city of Erie, there's a lot of blight in the city, a lot of homes that basically are uninhabitable, are close to being uninhabitable, Martin says. Once the manufacturing jobs are gone, what's left? People lose hope. They've lost hope. We used to be a place that made stuff. And I don't think people in Erie have figured out that we're no longer a manufacturing town. They still hang on the fact that because we still have, percentage-wise, a decent number of manufacturing jobs. Psychologically, the transition hasn't happened yet. We have not yet reinvented ourselves. We're talking about it. We're finally doing some things, Martin says. I think as a community, we're still struggling. I think our best years are ahead of us once we figure out what it is we want to be, but we haven't figured it out completely yet. Martin's own three adult daughters could not wait. After five generations making their way in the same town, this next generation of Martins has left Erie County for better opportunities. They would have liked to stay, but there are no jobs for them, Martin says. One's in Cleveland, one's in upstate New York outside of Rochester, and one's down around Meadville. So they're close, but they're not here for Sunday dinner. They are the kind of people Erie needs to stay. They all have advanced degrees and deep family ties, the kind of things that strengthen the community and the economy. Martin says, worrying not just about the numbers of people Erie is losing, but also about the county's ability to rebuild itself without them. If you take a look at the statistics of Erie, and I don't know the exact numbers, but they say the vast majority of people in Erie never even went to college, let alone have advanced degrees. So the brain drain only makes the community worse. Martin lost his wife, Sandra, at the age of 56, to breast cancer in 2011. She, a registered nurse who worked in the local hospital's critical care unit for 26 years, was a dedicated volunteer to the Erie community, just like her husband. Martin is the definition of a civic-minded businessman. He does not just talk the talk, he walks it. All of my family lessons have been examples of giving back to the community, he says. I have been blessed with disasters turning into gifts. To give back to my community is a gift we should all be willing to do. Martin's activism is more service than political, but he did inherit a strong interest in national politics. The last Democrat Martin voted for was Bill Clinton. Barack Obama's policies were too progressive for his liking. He did not care for John McCain or Mitt Romney, but voted for them anyway. And the first person who caught his eye during the 2016 primary election was John Kasich, the Ohio governor. He was my guy. I also liked Carly Fiorina. Trump was not my guy, Martin says, but quickly his voice becomes elevated. And then he came to my state. He came to my city. And I saw that he could connect with the very people who were being left behind. And that impacted me. Martin was not the only voter Trump converted during the candidate's landmark visit to the city on August 12, 2016, for a rally attended by 10,000 people at the local hockey arena. The reliably Democratic city is not a normal stop for candidates, much less a Republican, as the local paper noted the day before the rally. By stopping in Erie, Trump has signaled that he intends to continue bucking the trends of more traditional campaigns, the Erie Times-News wrote. But in most respects, there is little evidence to suggest Trump can turn the county red, or at least sway enough undecided voters to make a meaningful difference in Pennsylvania. But that's exactly what Trump did. The same county Romney had lost by 16 points, McCain lost by 20 points, and even Bush lost to John Kerry by 8. Trump won by 2 points and almost 2,000 votes. Erie's Democratic track record had been so unblemished that even Walter Mondale carried it in 1984, despite losing 49 states to President Ronald Reagan. Part of the difference as to why Trump won Erie and no other Republican has in recent history is that Trump actually came here. He showed interest. He told a different story. I believe Romney and McCain both just basically felt, hey, I'm the Republican candidate. Statistics show I can't win Pennsylvania, so I'm not going to spend any time there, Martin says. Trump did what nobody else did. He paid attention to the states that he shouldn't have won. And when he did that, that was one of the things that really brought people to his attention. People were craving someone to pay attention to what was going on in their community. Martin, like so many other civic leaders in towns like Erie all over the Midwest, did not initially prefer Trump, had misgivings about Trump, but had no problem voting for him in November. Did I like Trump better than Hillary? Absolutely, Martin says. But I do wish he would throw his Twitter account away and... Yeah, I do. He doesn't have to fight his own battles. The more he fights a battle, the more the flame grows. Martin also states he feels a part of something that is bigger than Trump. So I think whatever happened in 2016 goes beyond him. It wasn't about a person. It was about the community around you, even communities that are not geographically attached to you. The sense that Trump was looking at the overlooked and fighting for the forgotten in middle America enabled him to succeed with the upper middle class voters in places like Erie, who were scarcely different demographically from the suburbanites who were the weakest part of the Trump coalition. Martin, despite his religiosity and active Catholicism, was able to compartmentalize the jarring parts of Trump's demeanor that showed up throughout the campaign, including the sexism on the Access Hollywood tape. "I knew what we were getting when he ran for president. That's his personality. You show me a person, or you show me a group of people at a country club, and I'm going to tell you 5 out of 10 of them, maybe more, have said everything he said. Do I think that some of the things he said are offensive? Absolutely. But go across the spectrum of our country. It's there." In the end, for Martin, Trump's consistent praise of Americans who work and his pledge to defend them won out. "In my world, it just came down to being, I work hard. I've been fortunate to get to where I'm at in life, but it wasn't handed to me." Martin says he likes the direction of the third way movement of the Trump coalition. "When the American public voted, the halls of Washington hadn't quite figured out what happened. They're still fighting the party lines, and even within the Republican Party, the right wing of the right doesn't want to try to move any agenda forward," Martin complains, echoing a sentiment often heard among Trump voters who have come to trust him more than the GOP he ostensibly leads. The Great Revolt Survey asked Trump voters to rank the institution they most trusted to do what was right for the country. Trump was chosen by 60% of the survey takers, compared to only 25% who chose congressional Republicans. The fact that people like Martin, a Rotary reliable voter who by all rights should be a loyal Republican, share this sentiment is a wake-up call for the congressional wing of the GOP. "So we're back in gridlock, which, as far as I'm concerned, is only going to make Trump stronger moving forward," Martin says. "Because the guy who doesn't have a job, or the guy who's struggling to make ends meet, is tired of the politician who's a career politician." Martin, a late convert to Trump, well after he was the Republican nominee, sees in him a potential check and balance on traditional Washington. "In other words, there are the two parties, and then there's him. He's not an R completely. He's not a D completely. Both parties, at times, have turned their back on him." Jonathan Cochi, Freeland, Luzerne County, Pennsylvania. Freeland, Pennsylvania, population 3,500, wears its weary heart on its sleeve. When a sudden snowstorm plowed through here in late spring of 2017, Center Street, the main business district of this Luzerne County town outside of Wilkes-Barre, was impassable. So were the sidewalks, which meant the handful of businesses, which try to keep what little commerce is left here humming, were facing the prospect of days without customers. Jonathan Cochi had little choice but to take matters into his own hands. The slight 39-year-old with bright blue eyes, neatly trimmed dark blonde hair and beard, and an engaging smile, got his shovel and began digging. And digging. For several blocks and several hours. "I shoveled Center Street. And the sidewalks," he says matter-of-factly. "If I didn't, no one would get around. If the neighbors don't get out, then no one does any business that day, do they?" Cochi owns The Other Side, a bar and restaurant establishment that has been in his family for years. "My parents bought it in 1989. Back then, it was Eddie's Bar and Grill. They had another restaurant across the street called Northside Pizzeria. For years, we operated both," he says. "They closed the pizzeria after 39 years. The Other Side got its name because when we were over there," Cochi points across the street, "we said, we're coming to the other side of the street for the bar. And the name stuck," he explains. Center Street in Freeland is complicated. On one end of the main artery is MMI Prep, a private college preparatory day school that was funded by a 19th century coal baron who understood the need for technical schools in America that would provide education to students who would otherwise lack the opportunity to receive one. In 1879, the Industrial School for Miners and Mechanics opened its doors to fewer than a dozen young men who worked the mines during the day and attended school at night, giving them the technical abilities necessary to elevate themselves in the chain of command. The number of students grew, and so did the school, evolving from a night school to a day school to a sweeping campus with a college preparatory curriculum. It went from all male to co-ed, all along changing the lives of the sons and daughters of hardscrabble miners in the heart of this northeast Pennsylvania region that still produces 4.6 million tons of hard, hot-burning anthracite coal every year. MMI has an impeccable near-perfect success rate of its graduating students heading off to college, but it has also undergone an alarming decline in its admissions. In 2017, the school graduated 40 students, but its incoming sixth grade class has only 27. That decline is reflected, or perhaps related to, the decline of the stretch of Center Street's business district between MMI Prep and South Street. It is hard not to wonder how this entire Luzerne County town is holding it together. Storefront after storefront has shuttered along Center Street, and the flat, gray skies of the late spring afternoon add to the impression that things aren't just stagnant here, they are in a death spiral. People feel stuck. They do. They just feel stuck, says lifelong resident Jason Volchek, a deputy at the Luzerne County Sheriff Department, standing in front of a vacant business across from the Garden Chin Takeout Chinese food restaurant. A red and blue open sign, the kind you'd see at Sam's Club, was flashing as cars slogged by to jump on Interstate 80, presumably to get out of town. Yeah, no one really works here in Freeland anymore. You have to get on the interstate to get to your job anymore, he says, as he walked toward the other side for dinner. Every other car honked or waved at Volchek as he made his way for all-you-can-eat spaghetti night at Cochise Tavern. I am sort of like the unofficial mayor, he says. Any observer would conclude he is the mayor. Hey, Jason, was repeated five times in one block as the neighborhood deputy tipped his ball cap to men and women alike who shouted hello. Freeland is a town of used to be. It used to be a thriving coal town. It used to be a thriving manufacturing town. People didn't make bank, but they were able to keep a modest home, provide for their family, maybe buy a fishing camp in the Poconos, and carve out a decent middle-class life. Their jobs were mostly underground and mostly dangerous. Those days are gone. But Freeland could be a town of rebirth. Its location along the two interstates could be its saving grace, attracting folks working along those corridors looking for affordable housing, a place to call home. One sign of possibility is a brand new CVS store on Center. It replaced the locally owned Nochi's Pharmacy. The brand new fancy building stands out as the other buildings decay under the weight of neglect. Freeland is partly a suburb of Wilkes-Barre, the much larger but not healthier city of 40,000 nearby, and partly a town of its own. The decline started here in the 1940s with a 7% population drop. 20 years later, that loss dramatically doubled to 14%. It has never stopped bleeding souls since, although the declining percentages are now in the single digits per decade. The town's biggest employers are the Sotero Meatpacking Plant and the hospital. The plant employs around 100 people, used to be a lot more. The hospital is in Hazleton. Volchek says, of the Luzerne County neighboring town, 8 miles away, that launched the career of Lou Barletta, the local congressman and an original ally of Donald Trump, who is now seeking to oust Democratic U.S. Senator Bob Casey in 2018. We do have some manufacturing outside of the area and distribution centers, but really the jobs are hard to come by, and the ones that are here do not pay much. Makes for a real brain drain of young people, says Volchek as he heads into the other side. Most visitors entering town for the first time will notice the cheery, "Welcome to Freeland, Pennsylvania's highest borough" sign, with its skyline silhouettes of steeples and towers as the backdrop. With Freeland at just over 1,942 feet in elevation, the proclamation is likely untrue. The title could be more accurately claimed by many other locales far to the west, but it is legend for Freeland school kids as they grow up. Still, the views from the ridge are beautiful. Most of the media and pundits were stunned when Donald Trump beat back Hillary Clinton in this county in 2016. But given the Democratic history here, beat back is too mild a term. He pummeled her. For 6 presidential elections in a row, Luzerne County helped, or tried to help, place Democrats in the White House. In the 2 election cycles preceding the Trump-Clinton matchup, Luzerne gave Barack Obama its support. In 2008, Obama beat Republican nominee John McCain by 9 percentage points here, and even John Kerry and Al Gore carried it before that. But things changed in 2016. Trump even dragged Republican Senator Pat Toomey behind him for a local victory here. Toomey edged out his opponent, Katie McGinty, with just over 50% of the vote, 7 points behind Trump's number. In 2016, the signs were visible everywhere in Luzerne that its support for Democrats was thinning, but few noticed. Pennsylvania had been the ultimate tease for Republicans since 1988, tempting nominee after nominee to dump money into the expensive state that would eventually prove wasted. Many experts thought Trump and his allies, such as the National Rifle Association, were falling victim to the Keystone State trap, as they targeted it from the beginning of the general election campaign. Pollster Wes Anderson, who worked for Trump's 2 largest allies among independent super PACs, spotted Pennsylvania's competitiveness earlier than most. In a poll completed just before Labor Day, Anderson found Trump losing the state by just 0.1 percentage point, and winning the northeast portion of the Commonwealth that includes Luzerne County by 40 points. Media polls weren't as accurate. A CBS News poll in the field at the same time as Anderson's showed Clinton up by 8 points statewide, a margin that held until the end of October in that recurring media poll. When we told people the margins we had found for Trump in northeast Pennsylvania at the end of the summer, no one believed us, Anderson says, but they were right and they held. If anyone had looked at the trends here before 2016 closely enough, they would have understood that Pennsylvania was ripe, finally, for change. Since the 2000 presidential contest between George W. Bush and Al Gore, the state had become 0.4% more Republican in every subsequent presidential election. But Trump's win here was overwhelming. He flipped Luzerne County, which gave Obama 52% of its vote 4 years earlier, to earn a whopping 58% of that same county in 2016. He won in every single precinct, except for a few in Pittston, Hazleton, and Wilkes-Barre. People were weary of the professional politician, but no one seemed to hear us say that, says Cochi. We were here in plain sight, if anyone cared to listen. We still are. That sentiment has not gone away. The professional reporters and professional Washington still does not get it. They drone on and on every day, either on social media or on the networks, and report with just enough inference that you know they find his win not legitimate. It is as if our votes were not legitimate, he explains. Kochi is a young man with a big heart and a passion for his community. He has also been president of the local chamber of commerce and is just the kind of civic leader that you might have expected to opt for a more experienced and even-keeled presidential candidate than Donald Trump. On this particular evening, he is also the chef at the restaurant that he has owned for 18 years, since before he was old enough to legally drink a beer from the bar. The place is lively. About 20 people sit enjoying their endless spaghetti bowls in a restaurant that has paneling, a long bar filled with young people, an area for bands, and signs for upcoming events Kochi hosts at the tavern. If Cheers were relocated to Freeland, this would be that place. The other side has 12 beers on tap, carries 45 different bottled beers, and really has that welcoming neighborhood bar feel that you often see portrayed on television, but rarely find in larger cities with wealthier populations. In those larger places, people are more transient, more likely to try the newest place or trend, rather than be loyal to one bar stool and the bartender you've known since high school. We do lunch, dinner, we do bands, live entertainment, we do a lot of fundraisers, anything fun, a lot of different games. I can see the basketball hoop over there. That was from Final Four. It was a competition, best out of 20 shots. We had a big basketball rim. We gave them away, he says. He was born here. His parents were born here. He's not the guy who never leaves town, though. He travels extensively and makes visiting Europe a once-a-year adventure. I have a sense of responsibility to this town and this place, he says of the tavern. This is who I am married to. When she says jump, I jump. He lives upstairs, and his routine is that of a man who truly is married to his business. Well, I wake up early, two flights up, have breakfast, come downstairs, check on things, place orders for fresh food for the day, clean up anything I may have missed from the night before, and then get ready for lunch and dinner. He employs 18 people, runs the business, is often the chef, and is heavily involved in bettering his community. It's fun, he says sincerely. It has its challenges, but along with a lot of good rewards. The challenges, he says, are satisfying people. Keeping food fresh, homemade, not store-bought. Our meatballs are always fresh, he adds with pride. And they are, made in the southern Italian tradition, speckled with breadcrumbs and spices, and kneaded continuously so that the meat is light and airy, despite its denseness. Spaghetti night is a seller for us, especially the meatballs. We have prime rib and lobster on the weekends. It's really good. Yep. Homemade soups. My mom loves making soups. She's a soup connoisseur. She likes all different kinds of stuff. Chicken pot pie soup, BLT soup, gnocchi soup, butternut squash. Business, he says, is always a challenge. You always got to keep up with the new things, with the kids coming up, turning 21, activities, something for them to do instead of just come out to a bar. We like to be more than just a bar, where you come out, shoot some pool. We can shoot pool here, darts, anything. We'll even do cornhole. We'll do beer pong. We'll have flip cup. We'll have all kind of different games for them and competitions. We have beer Olympics coming at the end of this month. That's a lot of fun. We start on a Sunday morning and it goes until about 4 or 5 in the afternoon. It's a lot of fun. After he joined the local chamber of commerce, he quickly rose to be its president. Why? He wants to move Freeland up. He has friends in this town who have made it. And friends who are struggling, and friends who have left. There's a limited scope to what people can do in this town based on their talents and their professions. That is why we have this brain drain. Those of us who have made it want to keep a good mix of people living in the community, he says. Cochi is your standard businessman Republican. He's for lower taxes, fewer regulations, less government. During the election, he voted for Trump, though it took a while for him to get to him because of his personality. The persistence of educated, civic-minded voters who had reservations about voting for Trump but did it anyway defied the largest exertions of the Hillary Clinton campaign, which spent millions targeting Romney voters in key states such as Pennsylvania who had hesitations about Trump. It ran an onslaught of testimonial TV ads and radio ads with self-professed lifelong Republicans promising to put party aside and vote for Clinton, even though they may not agree with Hillary on everything. But in the end, Trump's business sense and bluntness appealed to Cochi, and the Clinton ads did not work. There was this sense of reality with him. It has gotten so in this country that you are not quite sure what you can say to people that might offend them. Things you would never think would make people offended. The politically correct stuff has gotten overboard. Certainly we needed corrections from crude or awful behavior, but we've gone overboard. You are afraid to talk to people. I didn't like the country's going that way, he says. Cochi worries that the last few years under Obama made people more open to racism. I don't like some of the things that were done. We're here in a small town where you could see lots of racism, but that's from people that don't get out and get on in the world. I don't care if you're pink, purple, black, blue, you're all the same. But I think there was a lot more stuff that would come up because Obama failed to use more common sense when talking about problems the country faces. Like, for instance, when it comes to fighting terrorism. Just say what it is instead of trying not to offend people. That reluctance, he says, was frustrating. He was also frustrated by how the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore was handled by the White House. I didn't like the way he handled the riots, where all these small business owners, especially in Baltimore, had their livelihoods destroyed for the riots. And he didn't do anything. Just said, just riot nicely. No, that's somebody's livelihood you're ruining. Those people will never come back. Most of them African-American small businessmen and women who worked hard to start a business. They were just destroyed in an effort to not let the police do their job? If rioters came and did that here, I'd be done. I'd have to go find something else to do. That would just destroy me. He also thinks that Trump might have the sense to understand how Obamacare has impacted business people indirectly. So my insurance went up almost $100 a month. Now think about that for a moment. That $100 a month is $1,200 less I have a year to spend on things I like traveling or entertainment. Now, you multiply that by a couple of hundred people, and that is a whole community that starts to have a loss in people using their services, he says. Obamacare impacted me, impacted everybody here, everybody. It is making it hard for the average working person to get ahead. You can't. There's too many bills. Cochi is very satisfied with Trump as president, saying he understands that disrupting a system that has been run by essentially the same class of people on both sides of the aisle, and news organizations that are used to being vaunted and not scrutinized, is going to make them attack him. He does not back down. I think he's still sticking to his guns. He shows every day that he is sticking up for the country. Honestly, I don't think 4 years is enough for any president to put something in effect to actually see how it's going to work. I was the president of the chamber for 2 years. It took 2 years to get the ball just started rolling again, he says of the local organization that lost its steam years ago. They needed somebody in there that I think was interested in the town and had a business and could see it from all around, not just in the center and look out for everybody. That's why I decided to do that, he says. His first point of action, get others involved. So we would ask people to join the chamber, and they would ask, what do we get with it? How does it benefit us? And honestly, at the beginning, I had no answer for that, because we